tell you.
Sorry, Michael, I forgot to turn the recording off.
Yep, that happens. The p-value is the probability of observing an effect as extreme or more extreme than that observed, assuming the statement in the null hypothesis is true. A small p-value can mean one of two things. The statement in the null hypothesis is true and we observed an unusual result, or the statement in the null hypothesis is not true. According to Ron Fisher, the smaller the p-value, the stronger the evidence against the statement in the null hypothesis. But how small should the p-value be to reject the statement in the null? Well, that is up to the researcher and should be decided prior to the data collection, data analysis phase of the study process. In 1926, Fisher suggested levels of significance of 1% or 5%, depending upon the goals of the research or the consequences of making a type 1 error. The only reason the 1% or 5% level of significance is used is because these were the values printed in his book due to the constraints of the printed page. In 1956, Fisher elaborated by saying, "No scientific worker has a fixed level of significance at which from year to year and in all circumstances, he rejects the null hypothesis. He rather gives his mind to each particular case in the light of his evidence and his ideas." Fisher also indicated a small p-value warrants further investigation, not that the p-value means the case is closed. As Ron Weisserstein, former president of the American Statistical Association, so aptly put it, a small p-value is like a good first date. You're not ready for a wedding, but are certainly willing to investigate the relationship further. So the null hypothesis, the statement of no change, would be there is no wedding. The alternative hypothesis, the statement we're looking to gather evidence in support of, is a wedding. So put another way, more dates means more data. Hopefully each date leads to data that allows for rejection of the null hypothesis. So if you asked your students to define a p-value, what type of response would you get? Do you believe your students have a solid grasp of what a p-value represents? Do you believe that your students truly understand what the models we use to obtain a p-value actually represent? If the answer to your question is no, don't feel bad. After the session's over, watch this video from 538.com where scientists are asked to define a p-value and they fail miserably. Okay. So is there anything that we can do to increase your students' conceptual understanding of a p-value? I believe the answer to that question is yes. What I want to do is go through an example where we use simulation to approximate a p-value. From this type of simulation, students will get a real sense as to what a p-value is measuring and how it can be used to judge statements made in the null and alternative hypothesis. Finally, this approach will allow students to see why models such as the normal model might be useful in finding p-values. So let's use this as an example. The proportion of the human population that is left-handed is 0.12. Mensa is an organization of high IQ individuals. To qualify to be a member of Mensa, one's IQ must be at the 98th percentile. In a random sample of 20 members of Mensa, it was found that 4 were left-handed. Does this result suggest that a higher proportion of Mensa members are left-handed than that in the general population? So this is an assignment that I do with my class. They have to work these out. I do them in small groups. So the first question that the students must answer is, what is the variable of interest in this study? If you feel like, go ahead and put in the chat your response to that question, and then whether or not it's qualitative or quantitative. Now, certainly the reason we would want to ask a question like this is because the type of variable is what is used to determine what type of analyses and what type of parameter we would have in our hypothesis test. I'm sure most of you are able to see that this is a qualitative variable that has two outcomes, either you're left-handed or you are not. And because of that, it lends itself to being analyzed via proportions. What are the null and alternative hypotheses? Well, certainly we know the null hypothesis is a statement of no change or no effect. And so the null hypothesis is that the proportion is 0.12. And the alternative hypothesis, the statement we're attempting to gather evidence in support of, is that the proportion is greater than 0.12. Now, what we're going to do is build a model that can be used to simulate the outcomes in the study. We always emphasize to our students that when we do hypothesis testing, we assume the statement in the null is true. So if there are, say, 120,000 members of Mensa worldwide, how many of those 120,000 individuals would we expect to be left-handed if the statement in the null is true? Feel free to enter your response in the chat room. And then, of course, a follow-up to that is, how many would we not expect to be left-handed? So if you are following through on this, your students and you should recognize that 12% of the 120,000 members are expected to be left-handed. That would be 14,400 of the individuals. And the remainder, 105,600, would not be left-handed. So let's go ahead and build our null model. I'm going to, in this example, use a simulation applet and ERN. The reason that I like to use an ERN is because you can physically identify the individuals. So we can say, all right, I'm going to have the 14,400 green balls be my left-handers, and then the remaining balls, 105,600, are going to be my red balls, my non-left-handers. Our original study sampled 20 individuals, so we're going to draw 20 balls. We actually observed 4 individuals in our sample that were left-handers. And so this summarizes how you would enter the data into your applet. So the green balls are our left-handers, the red balls are our non-left-handers. We're going to select 20 balls. We want to know how often we observe 4 or more individuals. In this applet, you can use either a dynamic seed or a fixed seed. You would use a fixed seed if you wanted all your students to get the same result, a dynamic seed if you want your students to get different results. Personally, I use the dynamic seed. We click compute. Now, what you would want your students to do, each one of them, is to click one run during your class and then observe the outcome. Here, the green balls, we have 2 left-handers and we have therefore 18 non-left-handers in our particular sample. So we did not observe 4 or more in this particular case. Click one run again, and it's very, very important that you explain, or have your students rather explain, what these balls represent. Each ball is a person. The color of the ball indicates their answer to the question, are you left-handed or not? Red, I'm not left-handed. Green, I am left-handed. Now we want, under this circumstance, to see how often we observe 4 or more left-handers. And again, we're building this model under the assumption the statement in the null hypothesis is true. The proportion of our green balls is 0.12. So we're going to do this over and over and over again. So I just click 1,000 runs a few times. And you can see up at the top, out of the 5,002 times that I conducted this study, 1,050 of those times I observed 4 or more left-handers. So the proportion of left-handers is 0.21. You can visualize the result in the graphic that shows the outcome of our study. Emphasize to your students, we've just conducted this same study 5,002 times under the assumption the statement in the null is true. fully 21% of the time, we observed results as extreme or more extreme than those actually observed. So this proportion, 0.21, is the p-value, the likelihood of observing a result as extreme or more extreme than one actually observed, under the assumption the statement in the null hypothesis is true. Now we can also compute that p-value directly if we wanted to using the binomial theorem. And so if we compute the binomial probability, we get something close to 0.21 as well. So a couple of points, additional points, is when your students do this, encourage them to share the results with the class. The student should identify the fact that the p-value, the proportion that are as extreme or more extreme, varies from study to study. It doesn't vary that much, and it's going to converge the more times you conduct the study, but it does vary. And so that's what the discussion should center around, is the randomness of sampling, that is sampling variability. A major conclusion from this scenario is that it is very difficult to reject the statement in the null hypothesis, even for large effect sizes, when the sample size is small. Put another way, a small sample size leads to studies with weak power, which is the ability to correctly identify an effect, that is, correctly reject the statement and the null hypothesis. And by the way, for those of you that are interested in R coding, I included in the slides R code for this as well. So if you wanted to use R, and if you want to learn even more R, go ahead to my website here and you can learn some additional R code. So I mentioned that small sample sizes made it difficult to reject the statement and the null. So let's explore that a little bit further. What we're going to do is the same scenario here, but rather have 20 members of Mensa. We're going to have 120 members of Mensa, and then have 24 be left-handed. So the proportion of left-handers in our study is the same, 0.2. And so we're going to build the urn applet once again. So let me go back here and I can build it again. All I have to do is edit this and change my number of balls drawn to 120. And then we have, you could either do 24 or more, or you could change this to a proportion. So I'll just show you the proportion this time instead of the number. But that's another nice feature here, is your test statistic can either be the raw number of observations or the proportion. Click compute, and I'll just run this 1,000 times for 5 times. And again, this means that we went out and conducted this study, surveying 120 members of Mensa, asking them, hey, how are you left-handed or not? And what we observed this go around is only 35 of the 5,000 result in an observation as extreme or more extreme than that actually observed. So here our p-value is 0.007. And by the way, the other nice thing about this approach is it gets students into interpreting p-values. I always have my students interpret p-values from a relative frequency point of view. This value of 0.007 equates to 7 out of 1,000. And so the idea here is that if the statement in the null is true, we would expect to observe results such as this in about 7 of every 1,000 repetitions of this study. And so we obviously observe something that's highly unusual if the statement in the null hypothesis is true. Another thing that I want to point out to you, or what we should have our students point out, is that the distribution of the outcomes is bell-shaped. And if I go back to this one, and it's centered near 0.12, as I would expect. However, there's natural variability around the expected number of left-handers, 0.12. And we measure that variability using the standard error. Again, more R code if you want to use that. And so another aspect of this that I do is tie that result that we just saw, how the distribution of the outcomes appeared bell-shaped, and then tie it into the normal model. So one of the things that you can do with this program is analyze your results. So all the these 5,000 runs, the results are exported, and then we can summarize these results. So if I do the mean and the standard deviation, the mean is about 0.12 as I would expect, and the standard deviation is 0.0297. And that's actually the exact value of the theoretical standard error, the square root of 0.12 times 0.88 divided by 120. And so we can use those theoretical values to approximate the p-value using our normal model, as I've done over here. And we get a p-value of about 0.004. From our simulation, we got a p-value about 0.007. It's kind of fun to talk about why these results might differ. First and foremost, the normal model, of course, is an idealized description of reality, and the fact that we're using a continuous distribution to model outcomes from a variable that is qualitative with only two possible outcomes. And so tying all these ideas together, I think, is very, very helpful for our students. Again, some more R code. In addition to using an urn to do these simulations, you can also use a coin. So if you download this PowerPoint, you can go to this YouTube channel and see an example of simulation using a coin. And I also have code at this link for how to use R to simulate using a coin. And then the question becomes, all right, do I use an urn or do I use a coin? When does each make sense? In my opinion, if the scenario is a sequence of events, like students entering a classroom, are they going to pass or not? Using the coin flipping approach is useful. The coin flipping approach is also useful when you have a 50-50 chance of an outcome, but the coin doesn't have to be fair to do this. We could have used the coin in our Mensa example as well, but I liked the Mensa using the urn because it's easy to build a population, and then students can really visualize what the population looks like and actually grabbing individuals from that population. So I want one other example that I want to go over here, and this is, do baseballs travel farther in Colorado? So Coors Field is home to the Colorado Rockies. It's considered to be the most hitter-friendly ballpark in Major League Baseball. One reason, of course, is the altitude. So the question is, do baseballs travel farther in Colorado? So the data that I'm analyzing comes from StatCast. If you're a huge baseball fan, you always, sometimes they even broadcast using StatCast results. It basically measures outcomes from every single pitch of every single game in Major League Baseball. And they're actually expanding that to Korean baseball as well. And you can grab data from their site. They measure lots of very interesting variables. The variable that I'm measuring is the projected distance of a home run. These are traditional home runs, meaning they crossed over an outfield fence. This is population data where the mean distance of all baseballs were home run baseballs were 400.3 feet with a standard deviation of 26 feet. So this is data from the 2019 baseball season. I'm not going to use the 2020 baseball season because of the shortened nature of the season. And so you can see the mean distance is 400.3 feet for all stadiums. The question is, do baseballs travel farther in Coors Field? And so our null hypothesis is a statement, again, of no change, no effect, no difference. I say that every single time when I talk about hypothesis testing to emphasize that point. No difference between other fields and Coors Field in terms of the distance of all travels. And then the alternative, baseballs travel farther in Coors Field. I have also started getting into requiring my students to write their hypotheses both in words and symbolically so that they make the connection between this symbolism and the actual study that we are conducting. So what I was able to do is from that StatCast website only grab home runs that were hit in Coors Field. Here's the data. And you can see the mean distance is about 417.8 feet or so. So it looks like a pretty big effect that's going on here in terms of the home runs in Coors Field. And it has a pretty nice shape to it as well. So here's what I would have your students do. Have each of your, give the students that data and have each of them obtain a simple random sample of size 10 from the data, and then compute that p-value using students' t-distribution. So this is the hypothesis test that we're conducting. Ask the students to share their p-values. Now, what's going to happen? The students are, of course, going to get different p-values. So the question is, why does this happen? Type some responses into the chat room to explain why different simple random samples are going to result in different p-values. I like Sasha's answer. There we go. So yeah, the p-value is itself a random variable whose value is dependent upon the sample obtained. For that reason, p-values are going to vary from sample to sample. And you can see that here. So here's one sample that I obtained. I got a p-value of 0.0078. Here's a second sample of size 10, and I got a p-value of 0.0141. Now, what's fun, in my opinion, and I assume in your opinion as well, is what if we did this over and over and over again? In other words, what if we obtained a bunch of simple random samples of size 10 and for each of them computed the p-value? What would that distribution look like? Well, these are the steps that you would follow. You basically would obtain a simple random sample of size 10 for, say, 2,000 different samples, and for each of those, conduct a hypothesis test and then store the p-values in your data table. And this is the result that you get. So notice that about 59% of the samples led to a p-value that is less than that 0.05 cutoff point. That is, 59% of the samples led to the conclusion that the mean distance of a home run in Coors Field is greater than 400.3 feet. That also means that 41% of the samples did not lead to the conclusion that the mean distance of a home run in Coors Field is greater than 400.3 feet. So the variability in the p-value is what Fisher and Wasserstein are referring to when they say one study is not enough. If you obtained one of the samples that led to rejecting the statement and the null, you would be saying baseballs travel further in Coors Field. If you obtained one of the samples that did not lead to rejecting the statement and the null, you would say baseballs do not travel further. Who would be correct? Without access to the population data, we don't know. Part of the issue with this particular study that we're talking about right now is, again, the small sample size. So once again, a small sample size leads to studies with weaker power. Again, power is the ability to correctly reject the statement and the null. The small sample size is what is contributing to this highly skewed distribution of p-values. And so the question becomes, what would happen if we increase the sample size? Well, if we increase the sample size, this is the kind of result you get. So here, I'm doing a sample of size 20. I just doubled the sample size and redid 2,000 random samples of size 20 and ran my hypothesis test. Now notice that fully 90% of the random samples result in a p-value that is less than 0.05. So a great question to ask your students, and one I'll ask you to reply to in the chat window, is why did this happen? Yep. Sample size increases power is a response that I just saw. That's right. So essentially what's going on here is the larger sample size is causing our standard error to decrease, and therefore a higher proportion of the sample means are going to fall into this rejection region. It's very, very important to emphasize to your students that all other things equal, ceteris paribus, a higher sample size results in a higher proportion of samples that lead to rejection. In addition, distribution of p-values tend to be right skewed. The results of the last activity tell us that the distribution of p-values depends on the sample size, but the distribution also depends on the effect size. And if you want to explore that idea further, which we don't have time for today, I would recommend looking at a different stadium. So I'm gonna show you where this data lies. I housed it in GitHub. So I have data for Miller Park, where the Milwaukee Brewers play as well. We don't have time for that today, but the distribution of p-values is substantially different looking than this for that particular stadium because it has a much lower effect size. Now, based on this, your students might want to say, well, geez, if that's the case, we should just always deal with very, very large samples. The problem with much larger samples, it leads to another kind of problem. You end up decreasing the standard error to a point where even a very small effect size is going to show up as being significant. And so before I go further, I put these three data sets on GitHub for you. So if you download my presentation, those links will take you to the data that we've been analyzing just now. And again, you can use R to do this. So this is some R code if you're interested in using R. I'll give a shout out to Danny Kaplan. I use the Mosaic package. It's a very nice package for intro stats. So let me give you a real life example of a sample size that's too large and what the consequences were. It was the Physicians Health study in which 22,000 subjects were followed over 5 years. So this was a cohort study. The question is, does an aspirin a day prevent myocardial infarction? My medical skills are pretty weak. But anyway, after doing the data analysis, the p-value was teeny, teeny, tiny. And this led to the recommendation of aspirin use for general prevention of that cardiac event. However, the effect size was also extremely tiny of 0.77%. And so what happened here is that infamous, we reduced the standard error so small that we were able to create a statistically significant event, but it really had no practical significance. So this happens all the time in studies, and you can point this out with this particular Physicians Health study. And the opposite of this can be true as well. When there are situations out there where there just are small effect size, and that makes it really, really difficult for researchers to find results that are true. So identifying a true finding in certain kind of diseases with small relative risks can be extremely challenging. I think it's important to have these kind of conversations with our students. I mean, the p-value is a powerful tool, but like any tool, you have to be very, very careful in how you use it. So these are the key takeaways that I want to get to, and then we'll answer any questions. First and foremost, it is not the p-value. Rather, it's the p-value for a particular set of data or a particular study. We saw that when we did the example with the baseballs, we're going to get different p-values depending on the data we actually collect. Secondly, a p-value that is less than 0.05 does not guarantee statistical significance. It's simply a first step. Replication of results is vital to validating a claim of association. After all, researchers, publish or perish is the old phrase, and the media are motivated by small p-values. A recent study that just came out was called groundbreaking in the news, and it said, science says a glass of red wine can replace 1 hour of exercising. And if that's the case, I should be able to do an Ironman exercise. Here's another follow-up to that. In 2015, the Open Science Collaboration repeated 100 experiments taken from the psychology literature. Of the 100, only 39 produced results that replicated the original findings. And so being able to replicate studies is the key. Another thing to watch out for is something that is recently being referred to as p-hacking. And that word is actually in the Urban Dictionary as defined as exploiting, perhaps unconsciously, giving folks the benefit of the doubt, researcher degrees of freedom until p is less than 0.05. Here's some examples of p-hacking that exist out there. How do you treat outliers? Collecting data until a significant result is found. So sometimes with these cohort studies, you can collect data from individuals, and then the minute you find a significant result, you just stop the study altogether because you're done. Selectively choosing explanatory variables. The idea here is that there is exploratory research and then there's confirmatory research. If you just start picking and choosing explanatory variables in your study until you find a significant result, you're p-hacking. Or elimination of observations. Oh, that individual didn't work out. I'm going to get rid of it. Now I have a significant result. Lastly, for your students, they should always consider sample size in the study. Small sample sizes mean small power, which is the likelihood of correctly identifying an effect. That's why that first example that we gave with Mensa was really, really important to compare what happens as you adjust your sample size. And then the opposite of that is something to be mindful of as well. Large sample size do not require a large effect size to identify an effect. And this is the infamous statistical significance does not without having any practical significance. And so the moral of this story here is that there is a sweet spot in sample size. And lastly, these are the three main articles that I used in researching this presentation, moving to a world beyond p-values, the role of p-values in judging the strength of evidence and realistic replication, and why most public research findings are false. There are links for these are in the, take you right to them in the PowerPoint presentation. And with that, I think what should I do? Unshare my screen and then I'm ready to answer questions, I guess.
Sure, go ahead. And if anybody has a question, please raise your hand. You can see your hand by opening the participant window and you'll see it at the bottom. Just a minute. So it looks like George has a question. I will unmute him so he may ask his question. Go ahead, George.
Okay, there you go. Hi, Michael.
Hi, how are you?
Great stuff. Thank you so much. A few of us were having a little discussion in the chat when you were discussing the baseball example about Coors Field, and you had that mean of like, I think it was like 400 feet for the home runs. Was that mean including Coors Field or not? Because if you included Coors Field, I would naturally inflate the mean a little bit. So were you looking at, like, for example, home runs in Coors Field versus home runs excluding Coors Field?
So the original data does include Coors Field. It was all baseball stadiums. And then obviously the second data set is exclusively Coors Field. And so, all right, would you prefer that the data not include Coors Field in the original data set?
George muted himself again.
Oh, okay. So, okay. That's fine. But George is right that by including Coors Field in the original data set where I identified the null hypothesis, that would cause that mean to be higher than with excluding it.
He answered yes in the chat. So.
Okay.
Anybody else with thoughts or comments? Giorgio, are you saying that you have a comment? Let me unmute you. I saw your real hand instead of your There you go. Okay. Go ahead.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, hi. Yeah, we were having a discussion on the side. I'm a little confused about the sample versus the same relative size of the sample. Doesn't really make a big difference if my population is 10 to the 23 units versus the population being 100 units. Wouldn't it make a difference, the sample being 1% versus 0.001%?
I wonder if you could ask that question in a different way. Are you?
So I'm thinking if I have a huge population, I'm talking about atomics 10 to the 23 units,
sure,
versus the population of 10,000 units. Should I consider not just the size of the sample, but the relative size of the sample? If I have a population of 10 to the 23, if I take a sample of 100 units, I could be anywhere over there.
Yeah, perhaps it, I mean, this is where we don't typically get into this in the intro course. And I was debating whether to get into something to the effect of taking more advantage of using power and effect size to identify sample size. I mean, right now, most intro courses, if they talk about sample size, they only look at it from the point of view of a specified margin of error, as opposed to what kind of power do I want out of the test. Certainly, when you have much, much larger population sizes, you have the ability to take a larger sample size because you can still have your independence requirement. I'm not sure I have much more to add beyond that.
It looks like Susan has a question in the chat. She says, this is inspiring. Any suggestions for motivating learning about type 1 and type 2 errors beyond what's typically in textbooks?
Well, I think that when you read those articles that I shared with you, there's a lot of discussion about type 1 and type 2 errors. What I would recommend is look at it from the point of view of any kind of existing research right now, where you consider the consequences of the type of error. You know, here I have something written down. Most textbooks, of course, talk about type 1 and type 2 errors in terms of the court system. But one other thing that I would add is, other than simply saying, hey, there's an inverse relation between alpha and beta, talk about the consequences of a low power trial and what that actually means is, what's the likelihood that you're actually going to identify the guilty in that type of a study. I've always found that presenting type 1 and type 2 errors from that point of view is important. And the second to the last article in that list gets into the role of type 1 and type 2 errors, and in fact does it in terms of research on certain types of medicines, where you can get a lot of false positivity rates in any kind of study. So I think that's read that article and you'll find some really interesting stuff.
All right, any more thoughts or questions? Let's all give a round of thanks to Michael. You can put your thanks in the chat box, and I'm gonna paste in there the links to the next sessions, the sessions for the next hour. If you've already pre-registered, you should follow the links that came in your email. If you haven't, as soon as the thanks get done, I'll paste in some links for the following sessions. Oh, all right.
And Anne, can I just add one quick thing?
Yes, go ahead.
So it was put in the chat box that if you want to access Michael's presentation, you're going to go to MyAmatic. So it's my.amatic.org, and you can get a copy of the presentation there.
That's true. Okay. And by the way, this background is Breckenridge, Colorado, a kick butt ski resort. I did good. Usually I'm terrible with timing, so.
Good timing. All right. Thank you, everybody. Okay, those links did not go in with a link attached. Interesting. All right, I'm going to pause the